A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a 14-month-old who's having an off day. Ezra feels warm to the touch, but the thermometer says no fever. He's eating less, he's quieter than usual, and there's a tooth or two coming in, which might explain all of it. Daniel's not panicking. He's asking what a low-touch monitoring protocol actually looks like for this exact situation. How often do you meaningfully retake a temperature when you suspect a fever, but the thermometer keeps saying no? And what's a lighter app than Baby Connect for logging temperature? The occasional photo for the doctor, and a few notes, without turning parenting into a data entry job.
This is a question about calibration. What to watch, how often, and what tools actually help. And the thing is, the scenario Daniel describes is so common that every pediatrician has seen it 100 times. The warm forehead, the pushed away bowl, the playpen that's a little too quiet.
The warm forehead is the part that gets people. It feels like data. Your hand says one thing, the thermometer says another, and now you're in a loop of checking and rechecking because one of them has to be wrong.
Right, and that's the first thing to untangle. The hand isn't a measuring instrument. Skin warmth is a poor indicator of core temperature. A kid can feel hot after running around, after a nap, after being bundled up, or just because it's late afternoon and their body temperature naturally peaks. At 14 months, Ezra is right in the zone where normal body temperature runs higher than most parents assume. The MSD manual puts the peak at around 18 to 24 months, when a healthy child can hit 101 Fahrenheit in the afternoon and be completely fine.
101. So Daniel's hand might be right, and the thermometer might also be right, and neither one is a problem.
Fever is defined as 100.4 Fahrenheit, 38 Celsius, measured rectally. A kid at 101 in the afternoon is at the high end of normal circadian variation, not sick. So the first reframe is that feels warm but reads normal isn't a contradiction. It's a 14-month-old being a 14-month-old.
And the second reframe is the teething question, which I know you have opinions about.
The teething evidence is unusually clear, and it's directly relevant here. There were two landmark prospective studies in 2000 and a third major one in 2011, and they all converge on the same picture. Teething is associated with irritability, drooling, gum rubbing, wakefulness, ear rubbing, and decreased appetite for solid food. It can cause a mild temperature bump, but it doesn't cause a true fever. The 2011 study by Ramos Jorge found the maximum mean temperature during teething was 36.8 Celsius tympanic. That's 98.2 Fahrenheit. Not even close to the fever threshold.
So if Ezra actually spiked a real fever, the teeth stop being the explanation.
That's the discriminator. Teething explains mild warmth and reduced solid appetite. It doesn't explain a temperature over 100.4, and it doesn't explain reduced liquid intake. If a teething kid stops drinking, something else is going on. Same with congestion, cough, vomiting, diarrhea. Those aren't teething symptoms, no matter how convenient the timing.
That's a useful line. The teeth are a plausible explanation for today, but they're not a license to ignore other signals.
The MacNin study from 2000 is the one that really nails the timing. 125 infants, over 19,000 child days of data, 475 tooth eruptions tracked. Symptoms cluster in an 8-day window, 4 days before the tooth erupts through 3 days after. So if Ezra's symptoms are teething, they should resolve within a few days of the tooth actually breaking through. If they persist beyond that window, teething becomes a less plausible explanation and it's worth a call.
19,000 child days. That's not anecdote, that's epidemiology. Somebody followed 125 babies around for months and wrote down every symptom on every day.
That's what makes the teething evidence so solid. This isn't folk wisdom. It's prospective data with a sample size that would make most drug trials jealous.
So we've got two reframes already. The hand isn't a thermometer, and the teeth explain less than people think. What does that leave us with?
It leaves us with the actual question Daniel asked, which is what to do. And here's where the fever phobia literature gets interesting. There's a well-documented phenomenon where parents systematically over-worry about temperature while undervaluing the behavioral cues that actually predict severity. A 2006 study found 82% of caregivers in an emergency department survey were very worried about fever. A 2022 Saudi study found 77% of parents believe fever itself is harmful. And a registry study of over 3,700 children found only 58% of parents felt confident the first time they documented a fever.
So, the monitoring protocol is as much about calming the parent as tracking the child.
That's the teaching moment here. The instinct to monitor is right, but the object of monitoring is often miscalibrated. Parents hover over the thermometer because it gives a number, and numbers feel like control. But the number is the least informative thing about how sick a child actually is.
The Merck manual says that directly, doesn't it? The height of the fever doesn't indicate the severity of the cause.
It does. Some minor illnesses cause high fevers, and some serious illnesses cause only a mild one. Difficulty breathing, confusion, not drinking, those are the signals that matter. The temperature is almost beside the point.
But here's the thing I keep getting stuck on. If I'm Daniel, and I've got a warm-feeling kid who's eating less and being quiet, the thermometer feels like the one objective thing I can grab onto. The behavior stuff is subjective. Is he quieter than usual, or am I imagining it? The number is the number.
That's exactly the trap. The number is objective, but it's objectively measuring the wrong thing. It's like checking the odometer to figure out if your car needs an oil change. Yes, the odometer gives you a precise number, but the oil light is the signal that actually matters. The behavioral cues are the oil light. They're messier, they require interpretation, but they're what actually track with severity.
So, the precision of the thermometer is a kind of false comfort.
It's a seductive false comfort, and the fever phobia literature backs this up. The parents in those studies weren't wrong to be concerned about their kids. They were wrong about what to be concerned about. They'd been taught, implicitly or explicitly, that the temperature number was the thing that told you how sick the child was. And that's just not what the evidence says.
So what does a low-touch protocol actually look like for Daniel's situation? No confirmed fever, a kid who's a little off, teeth as the likely culprit.
The guidance from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is blunt. You don't have to keep taking your child's temperature multiple times a day once you've established whether they have a fever. Other symptoms, and how the child looks and feels, are more important than what the temperature is. And that's for a confirmed fever. For a suspected but unconfirmed case like Ezra's, the protocol is even lighter.
So the 4-hourly interval that shows up in some guidance, that's for confirmed fever monitoring, not for this.
Right. The Hong Kong Family Health Service and San Antonio Pediatrics both cite every 4 hours as the interval for monitoring a confirmed fever. But Daniel doesn't have a confirmed fever. He has a warm-feeling kid with a normal reading. So the evidence-based answer is once or twice a day at most, or when the child feels notably warm. And between checks, the primary monitoring target is behavior and hydration.
What does that look like concretely? If I'm Daniel, what am I actually doing tomorrow?
Check the temperature once in the morning and once in the afternoon, or whenever Ezra feels notably warm. That's it. The rest of the monitoring is about wet diapers, fluid intake, interactiveness, and comfort. Is he producing urine at his normal rate? Is he drinking? Does he perk up when you engage him, or is he limp and unresponsive? San Antonio Pediatrics has the line that sums it up. A playful baby with 101 is less worrying than a limp one with 100.
That's the calibration in one sentence.
And the red flags that warrant a call regardless of temperature are specific. Fewer wet diapers than usual. Signs of dehydration, no tears when crying, dry mouth, a sunken fontanelle, difficulty breathing, inconsolable crying, lethargy or difficulty waking, a rash that doesn't blanch when you press on it, a fever lasting more than 4 days, or a temperature of 104 or higher in the 4 to 24 month group.
So the protocol is, check temperature once or twice a day, watch behavior and hydration, know the red flags, and otherwise let the kid be a kid.
And document lightly. Which brings us to the app question.
Daniel's on Baby Connect and finds it overloaded. He wants temperature, photo notes, and free text. Nothing more.
And that's a genuine product gap. The market is dominated by comprehensive loggers. Baby Connect, NARA, Peolog, they all want to track feeding, sleep, diapers, growth, pumping, milestones, the work. Daniel's instinct that logging all of that daily isn't healthy is well-founded. There's a critique from a Hacker News commenter years ago that still sums it up. You have to remember to enter the information, and what use do you get from the data? So you can monitor trends? Why?
The data entry burden becomes the job. The app that was supposed to reduce anxiety becomes a second source of anxiety because now you're behind on logging.
And for a 14-month-old, the logging is largely unnecessary. The newborn phase, when you're tracking feeds and wet diapers because you need to know if the baby is getting enough, that's a different situation. At 14 months, Ezra's patterns are established. What Daniel needs is a memory aid, not a monitoring system.
But there's a weird psychological thing that happens when you open one of these comprehensive apps and see all the empty fields. It's like the app is telling you that you're not doing enough. You open it to log a temperature, and suddenly you're confronted with 8 other categories you haven't filled in.
That's the guild architecture of comprehensive loggers. They're designed to maximize engagement, and engagement means more data entry. The empty fields are a feature, not a bug. They create a subtle pressure to use the app more, which means more data, which means more value for the company. But the parent isn't the customer in that transaction. The parent is the data source.
So, what are the actual options?
There are a few verified lightweight alternatives. MimiLog is free, offline, no ads, no sign-up. It's got a temperature log with a 7-level fever classification and a trend line, plus a free text journal and doctor visit logging. It can export to CSV or Excel for pediatrician visits. The caveat is, it's very new, single developer, created in April of this year, so it's a bet on a small project.
But the feature set is close to what Daniel asked for.
Closer than Baby Connect. There's also Baby Vault, which is an offline progressive web app built by a developer on paternity leave who got frustrated with data harvesting baby apps. It frames the need as 3 questions. When did they last eat? Are they gaining weight? And how do I show this to a doctor? That's the whole design philosophy. And it has a print-optimized medical export for quick pediatrician reviews.
3 questions. That's a product that understands its user.
There's also Vava, which stores data on device, syncs over the local network between parents, and supports voice dictation. No account required. And a few others, LuluTrack, Plumi, iShaw, all privacy-focused, all lighter than the big comprehensive trackers.
But the lighter alternative might not be an app at all.
That's the honest answer. A plain notes app plus the camera roll does most of what Daniel needs. Log the temperature reading, take a photo of any rash or concern, write one line about wet diapers and fluid intake, total time under 2 minutes a day. The photo is the part that actually matters for doctor visits, because a rash that's gone by the time you get an appointment is a rash you can't show anyone.
And the Notes app doesn't have a growth percentile module that guilds you into logging every meal.
The design philosophy worth adopting, even without the app, is Baby Vault's 3 questions. When did they last eat? Are they gaining weight? How do I show this to a doctor? If your tracking answers those, you're done.
So the answer to the app question is, there are a few lightweight options, but the real insight is that Daniel probably needs less tooling than he thinks.
And the answer to the monitoring question is the same shape, less thermometer, more watching. The object of monitoring should be the child, not the numbers.
I keep coming back to that fever app statistic. Only 58% of parents felt confident the first time they documented a fever. That's not a knowledge gap, that's a confidence gap.
And confidence comes from knowing what to watch and what to ignore. The parent who knows that a playful kid with 101 is fine doesn't need to check the thermometer every 4 hours. The parent who knows that fewer wet diapers is the real red flag doesn't panic at a warm forehead.
The protocol is almost a permission slip. You're allowed to trust your intuition without turning it into a data collection exercise.
Daniel's intuition is already doing the work. He noticed Ezra was off. He checked the temperature. It was normal. He's aware of the teething. He's asking the right questions. The risk is overcorrecting into a monitoring regime that adds stress without adding information.
But there's a version of this where Daniel reads all this and says, "Great, but I still want to know if the fever shows up at 3 in the morning." And the answer is, if it shows up at 3 in the morning, you'll know because you'll be awake, because Ezra will be awake, and the thermometer will be right there.
That's the thing about fevers. They don't hide. A fever that matters is a fever that comes with other symptoms. It's not a silent event that you'll miss if you're not checking every 4 hours. The kid will tell you. The behavior will tell you. The wet diapers will tell you.
The retake interval question, which is what Daniel actually asked, has a kind of unsatisfying answer. There's no magic number. It's once or twice a day, or when the kid feels hot, and the rest is watching.
The watching is the harder skill to develop because it doesn't come with a number attached, but it's the skill that actually matters.
We tested that, the field count thing. I worked QA for a baby tracker startup called Lullaby Log back in the early 2000s. The whole job was figuring out how many data entry fields a sleep-deprived parent could handle before they abandoned the app. The answer was about 7.
7 fields.
7. Past that, retention fell off a cliff. The founder kept adding features anyway. Growth percentiles, feeding analytics, sleep regression predictions. Every board meeting he'd come in with a new module. The app became a second job. User retention collapsed. The ones who stuck with it were the ones who never had to think about what to log.
That matches the clinical picture. The parents who do best with monitoring are the ones who spend the least time on it.
I still have the original prototype, Palm Pilot, in my desk drawer. It had exactly 3 buttons. Fed, slept, wet, and a free text note field. That was the whole thing. We tested it on actual parents, and the ones who stuck with it were the ones who could log an entry in under 30 seconds.
3 buttons and a note field. That's the entire product.
The founder thought it was too simple. Kept saying we needed more data to show value. But the parents didn't want more data. They wanted to write down when the baby ate and get back to their lives.
The Palm Pilot detail is interesting because it predates the smartphone app ecosystem entirely. The design constraint was the screen size, and it forced a minimalism that the modern app stores abandoned.
The constraint was the parent's attention, not the screen. A parent with a newborn has about 30 seconds of attention for any given task. If your app takes longer than that, the parent stops using it, and then you have no data at all.
The best tracker is the one that takes under 30 seconds per entry, and the market spent 20 years building the opposite.
The market built what the founder wanted to sell, not what the parents wanted to use. Same thing happens everywhere.
That's the product gap observation in one story. The comprehensive loggers won because they looked impressive in the App Store, not because they served parents better.
Now the pendulum is swinging back, with the Mimi Logs and Baby Vaults and Viavas all being small. Privacy-first, minimalist efforts. The next generation of baby tools might be judged by what they refuse to track.
That's the signal worth watching. The comprehensive logger model may be reaching its limits. The apps that are getting attention now are the ones that say no to features.
The Palm Pilot still works. I charged it last year. 3 buttons.
There's something clarifying about a tool that can't do more than you need.
The clinical takeaway is the same shape. The best monitoring tool for Ezra is Daniel's own intuition, calibrated by a few evidence-based red flags. Not a thermometer, not an app. Watch the child, not the numbers.
The open question that's still nagging me is that there's no specific evidence-based interval for the feels warm, but no fever retake. The 4-hourly guidance is for confirmed fever. For this exact scenario, the consistent expert position is that behavior and hydration matter more than thermometer frequency, but nobody's actually studied the retake interval. It's a genuine gap.
It is, and it's the kind of gap that exists because the answer is probably so obvious to clinicians that nobody thought to study it. Check once or twice a day, watch the kid, call if the red flags show up. The absence of a protocol is itself information.
The absence of a protocol is permission to use judgment.
Which is what Daniel was already doing.
I think there's a broader point here about the difference between monitoring and reassurance. Daniel asked for a monitoring protocol, but what he might actually be looking for is a way to feel okay about not doing more. The monitoring is the proxy for the reassurance.
That's a sharp observation. The monitoring protocol is the thing you can write down and follow, which makes it feel like you're doing something. But the actual need is to feel confident that you'll know if something's wrong. And that confidence comes from knowing the red flags, not from checking the thermometer more often.
The real deliverable isn't a schedule. It's a list of things that would make you call the doctor, and the permission to ignore everything else.
The list is short. Fewer wet diapers, dehydration signs, difficulty breathing, inconsolable crying, lethargy, a non-blanching rash, a fever over 4 days, a temperature over 104. That's the list. If none of those are present, the kid is probably fine, and the teeth are probably the explanation.
That's a much smaller list than most parents carry around in their heads.
Most parents carry around a list of every possible thing that could go wrong, and they're trying to monitor for all of them simultaneously. That's not monitoring, that's anxiety. The evidence-based list is short and specific, and it's the same list a pediatrician would use.
The protocol in one paragraph: check the temperature once or twice a day, watch for the red flags, log lightly of it all, and trust that a 14-month-old who's a little warm and a little quiet but still drinking and producing wet diapers is probably just teething.
If you're wrong, the red flags will tell you. That's what they're for.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want to send us a prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.